Thanks, Gary. It's always a pleasure to be in Santa Barbara. So today I'd like to discuss a little bit about this field of numerical relativity. So I'd like to start by acknowledging the collaborators I have in the various pieces of research I'll be discussing today. Eric Hirschman, former postdoc, now at Brigham Young University. Doug Early, former student here. Doug Early student, Steve Liebling, who is a student of mine at Texas, University of Texas at Austin, and Scott Noble, and particularly Franz Pretorius. You'll be seeing a lot of Franz's stuff towards the end of the talk. Also Robert Marsa, who unfortunately left the field and went off to work with a gaming company, Shadowbane, and so he's now chief technology officer there. Don't tell him I ripped off their logo. So I'm going to assume that you don't know very much about relativity. I realize that this is Institute for Theoretical Physics, and it's also UC Santa Barbara, and you have a big relativity group, but I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about last century's gravitation, general relativity, and then talk a little bit about black holes and gravitational radiation, focus on some of the challenges that we face in black hole simulations. Why is progress in this field sometimes seem excruciatingly slow? And focus on this notion of critical phenomenon gravitational collapse, and at the end, very end, talk about steps we're taking towards realistic black hole simulations. So first of all, let's recall that general relativity is quite an old theory, very old theory really. It goes back to the early part of last century. And what Einstein taught us, here's Einstein happily cycling around Southern California. He wouldn't look quite so happy, I don't think, if that were in Princeton. I don't know. Gravitational effects, according to Einstein, are a consequence of the curvature of space-time, and the curvature of space-time is a consequence of the distribution of matter and energy in the space-time. Now, general relativity, as most of you know, makes these spectacular predictions. Now, the universe itself is expanding, and we have black holes, and maybe even wormholes and gravitational waves. It really is the stuff of Star Trek, and of course, this is one of the reasons that we continue to attract really outstanding students to this field. You know, it's the stuff of Star Trek, even if they always get the science wrong. At least the vernacular is there. So let's start by considering an even older theory, Newtonian gravitation. In this theory, we know that the gravitational force on an object which has gravitational mass m sub g is given in terms of the gradient of a single scalar potential, the Newtonian gravitational potential field phi. So the force is just proportional to the gradient of that field. And the gravitational potential itself satisfies this Poisson equation. So the Laplace unify is rho. So we have a single Newtonian potential, a single field phi, which is essentially describing the entire gravitational interaction. Only objects with mass contribute to the mass density rho. So Newtonian gravitation, only stuff with mass plays a role. Also, Newtonian gravitation has this feature that it has action at a distance. Changes in the gravitational field propagate instantaneously to all parts of the universe. So in principle, when I shake my fist, you know, I'm changing the gravitational potential all the way out to the edge of the universe. And of course, Newton wasn't very happy with this, but this was the way things stayed for a few centuries. Now, one of the features of Newtonian gravitation is universality of free fall. And again, you're all familiar with this. So if we assume that inertial mass and gravitational mass are proportional with the same proportionality constant for all substances, then we can immediately deduce that the acceleration experienced in a given gravitational potential phi is a universal feature of that field. The acceleration is just minus the gradient of the potential. And here's the famous experiment of dropping a feather in an apple, and in a pretty good vacuum, they fall in lockstep. And so one of the things that Einstein did in formulating the theory of general relativity is to take that observation and elevate it to the level of a principle, namely the principle of equivalence, that what's happening when objects fall isn't anything really to do with a gravitational field. That, in fact, is the natural state of matter. What is unusual about the situation is what happens when the object hits the ground. That's what's unusual about that circumstance. And so, in a nutshell, the principle of equivalence states that locally, we can't distinguish a uniform gravitational field from a uniform acceleration. and that the real gravitational effects only show up, if you will, non-locally, through the curvature of space-time, so something like the second derivatives of the gravitational field. Now, one of the consequences of Einstein's theory is that the gravitational field becomes much more complicated than the Newtonian case. Heuristically, we can think that we now need four potentials rather than a single potential, as we did in Newtonian gravity. So again, heuristically, you can think of that as we're now going to be talking about a four momentum rather than a mass. So that's one hand-waving way you can get the four potentials. But in addition, there is something that's completely different, namely there are radiative degrees of freedom in this theory. So there are additional two fields, which are wave fields. And there is no action at a distance in this theory. Disturbances in the gravitational field travel at most at the speed of light c. And finally, and very importantly, all forms of energy act as sources of the gravitational field, including the gravitational field itself. And so there's this inherent non-linearity in the theory because, for example, pure vacuum space-times without gravitational radiation in them can induce additional changes in the gravitational field. Now, I'm not going to get into too many mathematical details, but just to sketch out the situation, the key field quantities that we're concerned with in general relativity are the metric, or is the metric, and you can view the metric as a 4x4 symmetric matrix of fields. So ostensibly, we have 10 fields here, and knowledge of the metric at every event or every point in space and time completely describes the content of the gravitational field. And the physical significance of this metric is that it gives us a formula for computing the displacement, the space-time displacement between two nearby events, or by integrating up that displacement between two arbitrary events in the space-time. So the space-time distance squared between nearby events is simply given by the quadratic form. ds squared is a sum from 0 to 3, where we typically label the time coordinate with 0 of g mu nu dotted into the coordinate displacements dx mu and dx nu. And one of the things that gives general relativity, and in fact special relativity, its richness of structure is the fact that those displacements aren't necessarily positive. And in fact, there's three different kinds of displacements. We can have displacements which are followed by material bodies. So here's a space-time diagram with time running up this way and space running this way. So here's the trajectory of a so-called time-like observer, such as you or myself. Those displacements are negative in the convention that I use. We can also have displacements which generalize what we mean for two events to happen at an instant of time. And space-like displacements, so in this picture, any line that I take that makes less than a 45 degree, or greater than a 45 degree angle from the vertical represents a space-like displacement. Things which are space-like separated cannot have a physical signal propagate between them. And then finally, we have displacements which are null, and those are displacements along which light signals or other signals which propagate at the speed of light can travel. So there's this very rich causal structure that's endowed or given to the space-time by virtue of the fact that the metric is non-definite. And relativists like to draw these light cones, which sort of indicate, given any given event, so in this case, this red event here, which events can be communicated, or which events that event can communicate with and which it can't. And the light cone, there's a forward light cone and a backwards light cone, separates those events this event can communicate, those are events in the interior of the cone, with the ones which can't be communicated with, and those are outside the cone. And so light cones are a useful heuristic mechanism for looking at the structure of space-time. Now, when it comes time to actually solve the equations of motion using a numerical approach, one way that's been very convenient and very successful is to use essentially a Hamiltonian decomposition. It's kind of ironic that a large part of this formalism was really developed in an attempt to quantize the gravitational field, but it's had its biggest impact in the solution of the classical equations of motion. So in this view, our space-time, schematically now, is the surface of the screen. And it's the space-time itself that I want to... Oh, sorry, David. Nice demonstration. It's space-time itself as a four-dimensional quantity that we want to construct, but we're going to construct it slice by slice. So there is no universal notion of time. There's effectively an infinite number of different ways that we could slice that space-time up. So what we're going to do is we're going to choose some surface, which will be our initial data surface, and we'll prescribe some initial data, which will describe the physical situation that we're interested in. And then we'll evolve that surface to the future or to the past to construct the entire space-time. And in that view, the forward geometry of the space-time, the thing that we're interested in, is now the time history of the geometry of one of these three-dimensional surfaces. So the fundamental variables, dynamical variables, then become the geometry of that three-dimensional surface. So that itself is described by a metric intrinsic to the surface, to the three surface. So it's a 3x3 symmetric matrix of fields. So I, J, and K now run over 1, 2, and 3. And we introduce a conjugate variable, roughly speaking, a velocity of that metric, which is known as extrinsic curvature. That's not too important. The thing to keep in mind is, instead of having these 10 fields, now we're thinking in terms of having these 6 fields, which we're going to evolve forwards and backwards in time. Now, relativity is invariant under general coordinate transformations. The coordinates on the space-time are arbitrary. They don't affect the physics at all. And this is a double-edged sword. It gives us a lot of flexibility in how we're going to describe the physics. But at the same time, we have to fix those coordinates somehow. They aren't given to us a priori as they are in most other areas of physics, where the, you know, I'm not talking about the difference between Cartesian coordinates and cylindrical or spherical polar coordinates. We're talking about actually having to systematically lay down the labeling in space-time as the space-time is constructed. And this is actually quite a difficult problem, and one of the things that hangs us up as numerical relativists. However, you can view the coordinate freedom as 4 degrees of gauge freedom, and it's a fact of continuous gauge transformations that you can eliminate 2 dynamical variables for every continuous gauge symmetry. So the counting goes, we started off with 10 metric variables, and we can eliminate 2 times 4 of those from the equation of motion, in the sense that if we look at things which satisfy wave-like equations, we're only going to have 2 components left. So there are fundamentally 2 dynamical degrees of freedom, 2 degrees of freedom in the gravitational field that you can freely specify as sort of wave content, and that will then propagate. And another counting, if you start from the 6 dynamical degrees of freedom here, then you can eliminate 4 using the gauge freedom. Okay, so we're talking about black holes. A black hole, by definition, is a region of space-time from which no physical signal can escape. Again, here's a space-time diagram. In this case, I'm illustrating, I've taken a diagram from Wald's textbook on general relativity, showing the collapse, perhaps, of a supermassive star. It's the outside of the star collapsing down, forming a singularity, a physical singularity, where the gravitational forces and derivatives thereof are becoming infinite. And drawing little light cones, which show what are happening to the ingoing and outgoing wave fronts as you approach the surface of this collapsing matter, and later on, the surface of the black hole, which is denoted by the dotted lines. And so what happens is you get closer and closer in this picture, closer and closer to a very strong gravitational field, is the light cones tip over so that right at the surface of the black hole, this dashed line, the outgoing light cone is focused exactly parallel. And so even though the outgoing light rays are still moving out at the speed of light, the gravitational field, in some sense, is pulling them back. And the net effect is that that surface stays at a constant physical radius, where we determine that physical radius, for example, by computing how much carpet it would take to cover the surface of the black hole. So at some point, we get this region within which no signal can escape, and this is the interior of the black hole. When the black hole settles down, and assuming that the black hole is spherical, there's a very precise relationship between its radius, again as measured by the area, the physical area, and the mass of the black hole, is just given by R is equal to 2 times the mass in appropriate units, where G and C are both set to unity. And it's also it's absolutely certain that inside the black hole we are going to develop a physical singularity. The singularity theorems of Hawking and Penrose tell us sort of very rigorously mathematically that this is what's going to happen. They don't give us very much detail about exactly what the nature of that singularity is. There's essentially no doubt in anybody's mind, at least from the classical point of view, that you really are going to encounter, you know, physical, very disastrous kind of singularity that would, you know, tear you apart, turn you into spaghetti, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something which is very difficult to deal with numerically, of course, and something which we need to avoid. So let me now just talk briefly about gravitational radiation. Prosaically, we can view gravitational waves as ripples in the curvature of space-time. At least in the weak field limit, they're very much analogous to electromagnetic radiation. They propagate at the speed of light. They're transverse. Their effects are transverse to the direction of propagation. There's two polarizations, so again, two independent dynamical degrees of freedom. And the frequency is set by the dynamics of the source. So there's, you know, a broad range, effectively an arbitrary range of frequencies of gravitational radiation. And as you all know, the NSF has been funding the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO, facility now for several years. The facility is completed in terms of the physical construction, and the interferometers are locked down for the most part, or they can be locked down, and they hope to be doing their first science runs very soon. Each one of these interferometer arms is 4 kilometers long, and what they're looking for are the periodic quadrupolar variations in distance between any two freely falling and separated objects, which are going to be induced by, in this case, if we imagine a gravitational wave impinging perpendicular to the plane of the interferometer, then, you know, the distance between this end station and here gets shorter, while the distance from this end station out gets longer, and then in the next quarter phase, that process is inverted, etc. And they're looking for these very small distortions. Now, in order to make gravitational radiation efficiently, we sort of have to look at the two dimensionless ratios in the problem. And the first of them characterizes the strength of the gravitational field. And for that, we take a look at the mass of the system. So if we have a system with mass M, from it we can assign a Schwarzschild radius, which is exactly the radius that system of that mass would have if it were a black hole, and that's 2g over c squared. And then on the other hand, we have the intrinsic size of the system, which is just its size. And we have to have the ratio of the intrinsic size to the Schwarzschild radius be close to unity, or else we're not going to get efficient gravitational radiation. And of course, this conversion factor is very, very small in any sort of reasonable units, the units we're used to, sort of 3 kilometers per mass of the sun, or, you know, if it's easier for you to think of the mass of the Earth, if the Earth was a centimeter, and then it would be a black hole. So you can tell from that immediately that, you know, gravitation in the solar system on the surface of the Earth is extremely, extremely weak. That's not all you need. You also need a significant redistribution of the mass itself internally at velocities close to the speed of light and in an asymmetric fashion. So, for example, if you just take a ring of particles moving at the speed of light, even if it's close to Schwarzschild radius, it's not going to radiate. And so the systems which are most likely to be detected early on by LIGO are systems which involve compact binaries. So in this case, the artist's rendition of a pair of black holes with some spin in orbit about each other, also a couple of neutron stars, for example. And the LIGO design sensitivities in its bandpass from 30 hertz roughly up to a kilohertz, in the phase one detection, or the phase one of the instrumentation, they hope to be able to achieve strain sensitivities of the order 10 to the minus 21. In phase two, they hope to be able to determine phase sensitivities of order 10 to the minus 23. And so even at this 10 to the minus 21 level, that's like determining the distance to the sun to better than an angstrom. Here's a figure from Barish and Weiss's paper in Physics Today on LIGO. And the key thing here, this is a plot of the frequency of the source, LIGO strain sensitivity, and they've indicated a few of the different types of astrophysical events from which they expect to see gravitational wave signals. And for the advanced detector, neutron star coalescence, so the coalescence of a pair of neutron stars should be able to be seen out to, close to the edge of the visible universe, and the event rate at that point should be several per year. The estimates for the event rates are still highly uncertain, but within, 5 or 6 years, with any luck at all, some of these events should have been detected, and if they haven't, then there'll be trouble one way or the other. Okay, so now let me get on to black hole simulations. We talked first about a few of the key challenges. So one that I won't focus on at all is the issue of how we formulate and discretize the equations of motion. There's a lot of flexibility there, a lot of work that's been done. A really key one is this notion of avoiding the singularity. I'll discuss that very briefly in the next slide or two. Computational demands, that's also a large challenge. Probably the overriding challenge right now is the notion of numerical stability. So, if you want to schmooze with numerical relativists at a cocktail party, just sidle up to them and say, how's your instability going, right? And they'll say, or maybe they'll say, which one? But they'll definitely be dealing with some sort of an instability. We also have to figure out how we tie into the observation, so how we actually extract the gravitational wave signal that's being predicted from the simulation. And then one that I'll touch on at the end of the talk is that we really have a shortage of personnel to do this work. So to avoid the singularities, over the past 10 years or so, we've started to pursue an idea that was advanced a long time ago by Bill Unruh. It took a long time for the field to take it seriously, but it's now taking it quite seriously. And that's that if we're interested only in what's happening outside of the black hole horizon, then we can literally throw out what happens on the inside. And so this is known as black hole excision, and it actually works. You can throw away the interior part of the spacetime, the part that's interior to the black hole, in a self-consistent fashion, just use the equations of motion up to and including the region that you're excising. There's a bit of a catch-22 in that the event horizon of the surface of the black hole is really defined in a global sense, and so you don't really know where it is until you've done the calculation. However, you can introduce what is essentially a local horizon. It's known as an apparent horizon. It functions as a horizon at an instant in time, and you can locate that at a specific instant of time in a given hypersurface that you're computing. And then what we do is we excise somewhat within that apparent horizon and carry on the calculation, advance the next time step, and relocate the surface where we're going to cut out and proceed as that in that fashion. And this is really proven to be crucial for long-time black hole evolution. In fact, as I was discussing with Gary and Jim this morning, mostly with Jim, that we have the situation in numerical relativity that people publish calculations because the black hole simulations last for a certain number of m. That's the fundamental dynamical time. And so though their simulations last for 100 m, that's good. And then if somebody's lasts for 200 m, well, that's reason to publish another paper. Whereas in any other field of astrophysics, if you're simulating a star, nobody, you can simulate it for a million years with a certain amount of computer time. There's no doubt that you should just be able to simulate it for 2 million years with twice the amount of computer time. That hasn't been the case here. Computational demands. This is an important restriction. We have, by and large, completely relied on finite difference methods for doing our calculations. And so a finite difference method, you take the continuum domain, so a two-dimensional domain I'm illustrating in this case, and you put down some sort of a lattice of points. In our case, the phenomena that we're interested in tend to be volume filling, and they're not particularly flattened, for example, or prolate or oblate. And so there's no reason to expect you to have anything but more or less the same number of grid points in any given direction. So we'll assume that we have uppercase N, so we have N good points in each of the coordinate dimensions. The space-time, or the spatial discretization scale, H in this case, is the fundamental numerical parameter in your calculation. Everything depends on that mesh scale, and you're really interested in the answers and the limit that H goes to zero. Now, then, trivial calculation then tells you that in D spatial dimensions, first of all, you're going to need order N to the D memory, but for a dynamical problem, you're also going to need of the order at least as many time steps as you have spatial steps. That's, if you just want to investigate a light signal traveling from one edge of your domain to the other, you're going to have that many temporal steps. So your CPU time is scaling like order N to the D plus 1. Now, heuristically, a minimum N for interesting problems is about 1,000. With the kind of finite difference schemes that we use, you don't really get to see much interesting happen or resolve a lot of phenomena unless you have about 1,000 points on an edge. And that means you really have a factor of 1,000 in going from D is equal to 1 to D equals 2, and a factor of 1,000 in going from the two spatial dimension to three spatial dimensions. So that's a factor of 1,000 is 10 CPU speed doublings for constant time, and that's about 15 years of hardware evolution. And now this estimate is pessimistic in some ways, but it's optimistic in others, because there's also an increase, for example, in the per grid point complexity as you go from a spherically symmetric problem to an axially symmetric to a general problem. Now, we're used to Moore's law, where we do get this doubling roughly every 18 months. There's some concern that there may be some kind of a flattening off in 5 years or so. But in any case, the crude estimates suggest that the general black hole collisions calculations require many CPU days on a teraflop, terabyte machine, and that's for a single calculation. This simple-minded analysis also ignores two key facts about at least our kind of simulation-based science. That is, number one, when you don't know a good solution method, and we still don't know a good solution method, you need a turnaround time on the order of hours or maybe days at most, certainly not weeks or months, in order to make effective progress, or else your graduate students will just never graduate. And the second thing is that a few simulations aren't going to cut it in general. Most interesting problems are going to have considerable parameter spaces to explore, and this introduces additional effective dimensionality into the problem. And then as a remark, I know that there's lots of room here for gains due to improved algorithms, and that's also an issue that we're working on. So this brings us to the issue of model problems. So here's a spherical cow, and that's exactly what we're going to be doing. We're going to reduce the computational demands by imposing symmetry conditions, which reduce the effective spatial dimensionality of the problem. So we still study the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory, but now we impose a space-time symmetry. So we either consider a D equals 1, or a spherically symmetric problem, where we have symmetry under all rotations about a point, or D equals 2, an axisymmetric problem, where we have symmetry under rotations about an axis. And we hope that these models will reveal, as we're solving them, reveal interesting physics which won't depend crucially on the symmetry assumptions. But we also will use those model problems to develop the techniques for the more realistic calculations. And so I'm going to show you some spherically symmetric calculations just to sort of hammer home this point about the 15-year business. These were initiated in earnest about 1990. I'll show you some axisymmetric calculations, which are still ongoing, and the turnaround times are still a few times longer than for the 1990 spherically symmetric calculations. And so this estimate of 15 years from going from one dimension to another, I don't think is too outlandish. Okay, it's a black hole critical phenomenon. Let me describe the basic picture here. We're going to consider parameterized families of initial data which represent the gravitational collapse of some matter field. We're working in spherical symmetry, so we're going to have to introduce a matter field to have any kind of dynamics at all. And I'm going to set up my computational apparatus as follows. I'm going to have a single parameter, a single control parameter, P, that I can tune. That's going to tune the initial data. But what it's going to do is also control how strong the gravitational field is downstream of the initial data. The idea in mind will be I'll set up some initial data that's going to be imploding on itself, and the implosion will result in a gravitational field, loosely speaking, reaching some maximum strength, and tuning that initial data parameter is going to control how strong that subsequent evolution becomes. And all I'm going to demand from that parameterization is the following. I'm going to demand that if P is less than a critical value P star, no black hole form, whereas if P is greater than the critical parameter, a black hole forms. And then by definition, P is equal to P star is going to be the threshold of black hole formation. So in this parameterized search, it's going to be the place where I first detect black holes forming. And then I can ask all sorts of questions, but perhaps most fundamentally is what's the nature of the black hole to no black hole transition. This is something that Dimitri Christodoulou got me thinking about many, many years ago. If we consider plotting the fraction of the mass, of the total mass of the system, which ends up in a black hole, as a function of the parameter value, then we can ask questions such as, does the black hole which first forms, or the black hole which forms at criticality, have a finite mass or an arbitrarily small mass, infinitesimal mass? And I'll call these two situations type 1 and type 2 in loose analogy to statistical mechanical systems, viewing the mass as an order parameter, and I'll actually show you examples from both kinds of calculations. What we've found in these studies is that the black hole threshold is, first of all, it is generic. No matter which model we consider, we see one of these thresholds. And it's generically characterized by exponential sensitivity to the initial conditions. So no matter how you originally built your apparatus, or how clever you were in choosing that parameter, that single knob, what you're going to want at the end of the day is an infinite vernier, an infinite series of knobs so you can tune the fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth decimal digit in that raw parameter space. We also find that for any collapse model, we find universal solutions, universal in the sense that they seem to be isolated in solution space, with additional symmetry. So the type 1 solutions, those solutions where a black hole forms with finite mass at threshold, have been found to either be static or periodic, whereas the type 2 solutions are either continuously or discretely self-similar. And the discrete self-similarity is something which is sort of pops out of the calculations and was largely unknown, I think, it's fair to say, in mathematical physics until these sorts of calculations. That's not too surprising. If you aren't doing this sort of calculation, it's a very hard symmetry sort of to stick it in as an ansatz and compute with. Associated with these critical solutions, we find universal scaling laws for solutions which are near criticality. So for example, in the type 2 collapse, where the mass of the black hole is infinitesimal at threshold, we find that the mass of the black hole scales like P minus P star to a power gamma. And this gamma is a universal exponent in the sense that it doesn't depend on the parameterization, i.e. on the specific initial data family that you're using. And here's typical data where I've plotted the log of the mass of the black hole versus log of P minus P star. And you see the very, very good linear trend here. And in this picture, I show the mass of the black hole itself versus the parameter. You can see the sort of characteristic second order phase transition. So very quickly, I'm going to show you some details of the calculations that come from the model where this behavior is first observed, massless scalar collapse, sort of the simplest fully general relativistic model you could conceive of. So G equals C equals 1 in spherical symmetry. The matter field is a massless scalar field. You can think of this as some sort of a scalar electromagnetism. Okay. The scalar field itself is specified by initial profile, phi as a function of R, and its time derivative. The dynamics is just an imploding and exploding shells, spherically symmetric shells of radiation. And there's a fundamental nonlinearity, which is intrinsic to any general relativistic problem, which gives rise to competition. And it's certainly true that it's this competition which gives rise to the critical phenomena. So you can understand this competition by asking the question, where can the energy in the system end up? This field is massless. It has no rest mass. It's got kinetic energy, which couples to the gravitational field. But naturally, it wants to escape to infinity or disperse to large distances. You just can't, in flat space-time at least, you can't localize it. And so its kinetic energy wants to get the field all out to R equals infinity. And that's what I'll call complete dispersal. So in the very weak field case, I have a pulse of radiation comes in, goes through the origin, and then escapes. And I'll show you an example of that in a second. Once we couple to the gravitational field, however, we now have, if you will, potential energy, which, if the gravitationally induced self-coupling is strong enough, will tend to trap the black hole, trap the radiation within a black hole. So we can now localize that energy within the black hole. And from that, we can also play off the two effects to generate the critical solutions, and that's essentially what's being done here. We have two stable long-term end states, generically, in the parameter space, one with material all dispersed and one with material in a black hole. And we're going to tuning the solution to an unstable state, which is the critical solution. So in the weak field or flat space regime, the metric is simply the flat metric written in spherical coordinates, and the scalar field equation of motion is simply an ordinary wave equation for the quantity r times phi, which has general solutions, which are just superpositions of ingoing and outgoing waves. So r times phi as a function of r and t is just some part which describes a profile which is moving inwards, and some part which describes a profile which is moving outwards. And it's completely analytically tractable, but nonetheless, I can show you an actual evolution here. So you're going to see several of these animations where I've taken spherically symmetric data and turned them into surfaces of revolution. The initial data then is this Gaussian pulse. Its derivative has been set so that the radiation is all initially moving inwards. And you'll see that what happens is that the radiation moves inwards, the amplitude of the field grows, like 1 over r roughly, and then the field completely disperses. And the only sort of interesting thing is that there's this inversion in the sign of the field. So I'll show that once more. So phi goes to minus phi, but you can work out that that's exactly what happens for the scalar wave equation in spherical symmetry. Now, in the strong field regime, things don't get too much more complicated. The metric, if I choose my coordinate system appropriately, I choose my radial coordinates so that the surface of r equals constant spheres is still given by 4 pi r squared. I have to introduce two functions, alpha and a, which are functions of r and t. And then I'm going to introduce these additional scalar field variables, which are just the spatial and temporal gradients up to factor a over alpha. For those of you who know some relativity, if you take a look at this form, you may recognize that this is the form of the Schwarzschild line element, generalized for time dependence. And then that suggests that I write a squared as 1 minus 2 times a function m over of r and t over r all inverse. And in fact, if we do that, then you can interpret that function m as measuring the amount of mass within a radius r at a given time t. And furthermore, if we integrate up the quantity dmdr over all radius, then we get the conserved mass at infinity via dm mass. And so now I'm going to show you what happens when we turn up the coupling. I don't want to dwell on the equations of motion at all. I'm a little short of time. What you're going to see here now is essentially identical initial data where I've just adjusted the amplitude of the pulse. And what you'll see is more or less the same kind of evolution, except now in the trailing edge of the waveform, there's an overshoot. And you'll start to see this is the first sort of signature of the nonlinearity in the model. And as I tune closer and closer to criticality, I get additional features appearing in that trailing edge of that waveform. And I'll show that in a second. So the game here now, again, is to choose an arbitrary parameter, one parameter family of initial data, locate some initial bracket that I've already showed you an example of, a bracket p minus p plus, such that if p minus is less than p star, so I have no black hole, and p plus is greater than p star, so I have a black hole. And then I refine that bracket using, for example, a bisection search. And so what I show in this animation is what's being changed as I tune that parameter. So this is just showing you that the only thing that's changing is this overall amplitude of the scalar field. That's the only thing that changes from run to run. And the interesting thing is that we can tune to machine precision and see qualitative changes in the solution output, provided that the code has enough dynamic range. So to get the results that I'm going to show you, you have to have a code that introduces additional spatial and temporal resolution as it's needed. But modulo that, what prevents you from getting to the critical point is really the finite precision nature of the arithmetic. So here's another view of a pair of bracketing solutions. I'm actually plotting a space-time, time running out this way, space running out this way, view of two calculations, the mass function. This is a weak field evolution. So in these mass plots, anywhere where I have a flat area, that's a vacuum area, and anywhere where I have a flat area at m equals zero is flat space-time. And so in both cases, the pulse is imploding in this flat space-time to the interior of the pulse. In the weak field case, the pulse explodes and leaves flat space-time behind. In the strong field case, I'm left with a vacuum region at non-zero mass from which I can read off the mass of the black hole. The other thing to notice is that the scalar field here evacuates on a dynamical time scale set by the size of the black hole. Namely, the scalar field doesn't linger around the black hole horizon. So there's really no difficulty in detecting when we've got black holes forming these calculations. So in the near critical regime, what we find, we tune the control parameter, essentially the machine precision, and then as P goes to criticality, we find that this unique critical solution emerges, so the details of the initial data wash away, but the critical solution, interestingly enough, is discretely self-similar. And so what you'll see here, so this is going to be one of these solutions which is as tuned as close to criticality as possible. There's the initial pulse profile. This is now a logarithmic coordinate, and it's also a logarithmic, well, the evolution time is also logarithmic. You'll see that if you watch carefully, the time is slowing down. You see these series of echoes that are unfolding now regularly in a logarithmic spatial coordinate. The physical interpretation of that is that it's the same dynamics that's being played out on ever smaller and smaller spatial scales and faster temporal scales. Every one of these oscillations represents the same dynamics happening on a scale of about 30 times smaller than the previous scale. And associated with each of these oscillations, because the scalar field is essentially oscillating back and forth faster and faster, the curvature itself grows basically as the square, reciprocal square of the distance scale. The curvature itself grows without bound, and there's absolutely no apparent horizon or event horizon forms. And so in the precisely critical limit, you form this single event which has infinite curvature and which in principle is visible by observers at arbitrary large distances, i.e. it's a naked singularity. But it's clearly not generic. I mean, this critical solution by construction is unstable because we're tuning off against the two stable end states. And so we can understand a lot of what's going on here by considering the self-similarity of these type 2 solutions. So schematically now, I've drawn a space-time diagram. And once we found one of these critical solutions, then we recognize that there's this singular point, this sort of accumulation point of all these echoes. We know that it occurs at r equals zero. We don't know what time it occurs at until after we've done the calculation. But having done that, this then becomes the natural origin with which to describe the physics. And then essentially the self-similarity says that we have these self-similarity lines given by zeta, which is r over t is equal to constant, and the evolution along these lines is essentially, there is no evolution along these lines. The only evolution you see are the changes, the dynamical change as you cut across the fan. And so to look at that in a little bit more detail, if I now go into a logarithmic coordinates, so rather than using rho, r, and t, I use tau, which is log of t, and rho, which is log of r, then those self-similarity lines now just become constant slope lines moving to the left. A continuously self-similar solution is described by some kind of a pattern just moving to the left with unit pattern speed. The twist here, the sort of interesting twist, is that as we evolve in the discretely self-similar case along these similarity lines, there's some non-trivial evolution, but that every so often in log space, we get back to where we started from. So there's this periodicity in log space, and so there's an additional exponent that comes out of the calculation, this delta, which tells you by what factor the dynamics is rescaling. Okay, so just quickly to summarize the features, key features of this type of collapse. By definition, we can make arbitrarily small black holes. The critical solutions we see are self-similar, possibly discretely self-similar. The precisely critical solutions contain naked singularities, but their formation is decidedly not generic. And we get scaling laws that I haven't discussed much, but we find scaling laws for the dimensionful physical quantities, such as the black hole mass. And we find universality, that we see these same features for a fixed model, regardless of the initial data. And here's the modified, Stephen Hawking made a bet with Thorne and Preskill that from regular initial data, you wouldn't be able to, regular initial data of reasonable matter in a scalar field was construed to be a reasonable form of matter, you wouldn't be able to form a naked singularity. And he just modified the bet as follows. He had lost the previous bet by not demanding genericity, and so they put in the genericity clause, and it remains to be seen whether or not we'll be able to violate cosmic censorship in other fashions. On this? I'm willing to I'm willing to bet either side, actually. Because I don't think I'll have to pay it. let me think about it. I went the wrong way here. Okay, so the interesting thing here is that we now understand quite a bit of the phenomenology from the point of view of perturbation theory. It can be couched in normalization group terms, but it really is perturbation theory. The black hole threshold solutions are unstable by construction, but the evidence suggests that they're minimally unstable, i.e., that there's only one unstable mode. And so schematically then, this is the picture of the stability manifold of one of these calculations. We've got the upturned part of the saddle, which represents the infinity minus one number of modes, because these are infinite dimensional problems, which are stable. And then we've got one unstable mode. And then depending on what sign of mode is present in the initial data, we either get kicked over to black hole formation or dispersal. And there really is nothing more to it than that. And what we're doing when we're tuning to criticality is just tuning out that unstable mode. And then the scaling law exponent is just a reciprocal Lyapunov exponent of the unstable mode. And this explains most of the phenomenology and universality. And once you've accepted that there are these isolated universal solutions and the perturbation theory is universal, and all you're doing when you change families is finding different ways of getting to the solutions. Okay, I won't have time to talk about the critical Yang-Mills collapse. I want to quickly show a type 1 solution. So this is work Scott Noble, graduate student, is currently doing. In this case, we again consider spherically symmetric gravity, general relativity, but now we couple it to a perfect fluid with an ideal gas or Singh equation of state, that the pressure is some constant times the rest energy density times the enthalpy parameter epsilon. And gamma for causality has to be restricted to the range 1 to 2. And as anybody who studies stellar structure knows, with these sorts of models, you can construct families of static solutions, which can be interpreted as stars, which are parameterized by their central density. So what I've plotted here is log of the central density and the mass of the resulting configuration. And it's typical of these sorts of calculations that the mass increases up to a certain maximum, at which point the mass actually starts to decrease as a function of central density. There's a turning point here, and the stars on this side of the branch are stable, the ones on this side are unstable. And so in fact, the stars here are one mode unstable solutions, and what you're going to see in these calculations are, what you see in this in the next animation, is a solution which starts off on the stable branch, which is then highly perturbed by an imploding shell of scalar field, which interacts only through the gravitational field, essentially pops the star over to the unstable branch, and sits there for a little while, actually a length of time which is proportional to log of p minus p star. And then, depending on which side of the unstable mode is present in the initial solution, either collapses to form a black hole of finite mass, or relaxes back to a neutron star with whopping perturbations. And so that's exactly what's going to be plotted here. This is, again, a radial coordinate, logarithmic radial coordinate. This is the quantity that's being plotted is dmdr. This is dmdr, the contribution from the mass of scalar field. It looks like it's small, but that's largely because it hasn't been multiplied. Well, it looks like it's fairly small, but it's actually quite significant. And the dynamics here is such that the time scale for the pulse to move in and out is extremely quickly. So you're all supposed to, yes? Oh, we've put in a one or some constant to regularize it. It's basically set by the minimum distance that we want to resolve. So it'll be pretty amusing. You'll see this little pulse race in and outwards very quickly, but then you'll see the star get compacted. So there, happens really quickly. Now the star is sitting there. I'll play it again. It's in that one mode unstable state. It's basically the same mass, but a smaller radius. And then later on, when it comes off that near critical state, it relaxes back to a neutron star with very large perturbations. So again, this is the critical state. There's some oscillations there, which are essentially the second mode, which is still a stable mode superimposed on this unstable star. But you can play the same tuning game where you can, you know, tune to this unstable solution dynamically. Yes, sir? Yes, exact. It's imposed. I'm going to get to that in 2 minutes. Well, okay, this is actually a fluid in a box, and so there's a very poor transmission. In fact, there's no outflow conditions here. It's just the outer boundary. So there's some reflection, but the amount of scalar field itself propagates off. There's a little bit of fluid reflection, but that's completely dynamically unimportant, especially from the gravitational point of view. So you actually see there's a little bit of a defect out here that hangs around. But if we can push the outer boundary out further and further, and it has no impact on the dynamics. So in this case, you find a type 1 transition because a black hole which forms a finite mass. So it's of decided interest to go beyond spherical symmetry and to see what the stability of these configurations are to non-spherically symmetric perturbations. This has been done in perturbation theory. And for certain of these solutions, it's been shown, at least in perturbation theory, that there are no additional non-spherically symmetric unstable modes. Okay, so particularly for the scalar field solution, it's known that there are no additional unstable non-spherical modes. But we want to investigate this in any detail, in any case, possibly far from spherical symmetry. And so we're working on this axisymmetric code, which also involves a scalar field, but in this case we can also study pure vacuum spacetimes. And this is from an axial symmetric code. So again, this is largely the work of Franz Pretorius, who has a PhD degree, he's just finishing up. This is now from an axisymmetric code. It's the same kind of plot that you've seen before. There's a logarithmic coordinate being shown here. It's spherically symmetric data, but it's in an axially symmetric code, so there's the possibility for non-spherically symmetric perturbations, at least from a numerical point of view. And what you see is precisely the same kind of behavior. Now, things look a little bit jerkier, but again, the computational demands here are literally 1,000 times greater than were before. And the resolution here, you can't really tell, but is many orders of magnitude greater at the final time than it was at the initial time. The solution is a good match to the result from the spherically symmetric code. And just to give you some idea of the type of dynamical range that the code needs, I'm showing you here a plot of the actual mesh structure so you can sort of make out the individual grid cells. And it's not a very clear video, but you'll see as time progresses, you know, various refinements pop into existence. And this is a continuous zoom into the phenomena. And this is the sort of thing that we're resolving at the final time, you know, many orders of magnitude smaller than the original discretization scale. Stable black hole solutions, yes. And so again, I can show you that next movie. So moving on to something which is sort of completely different from critical phenomena, gets back to the notion of how we evolved black hole spacetimes for a long time. I'm showing you here some other calculations that Franz has done, where he's taken two scalar pulses of radiation, which are boosted towards one another, each of which promptly collapses to form a black hole, and then each of which has its insides excised, and these black holes collide and they merge, and then they run, the calculation runs for a very long time. And it's, so here's the black hole, and as I'm saying, it used to be, well, there would be one letter, FISREV letter, and then that would be another FISREV letter, and then that would be another one, right, et cetera, et cetera. But with this code does a reasonable thing, namely, when it's dealing with the quiescent, static, you know, completely boring Schwarzschild solution, it just keeps evolving it forever and a day. But it's crucial that we cut out the inside of the black hole to do that. There were calculations done in the late 80s by Shapiro and Tucholsky, late 80s, early 90s, which addressed the problem of cosmic censorship. They used collisionless matter, basically Vlasov equation coupled to Einstein equation, and they found that for sufficiently prolate, sufficiently cigar-shaped configurations of matter, there was evidence that they could perhaps form naked singularities. And so we've been trying to repeat these calculations again with what we consider more realistic form of matter, matter with pressure. So this is an extremely prolate Gaussian, right? This shark fin kind of configuration is actually a very, very cigar-shaped Gaussian pulse. And it undergoes all sorts of complicated dynamics. But what we find at the end of the day is a very neat spherical black hole sitting in the center. And there's absolutely no evidence from these sorts of calculations, at least so far, of any violations of cosmic censorship. But we'd like to extend these calculations to put in a mass of the scalar field, and that may change the picture somewhat. Now, just to finish up, getting on to what we really, in the long term, want to do, realistic black hole calculations. Again, the event rate of black hole, neutron star, or black hole, neutron star mergers is highly uncertain, but it's expected that for advanced LIGO, we should be seeing a few per year. And this, of course, requires fully three-dimensional computations. And it's also certainly going to require, I should change this, it's not going to probably, it's going to require adaptive mesh refinement techniques, and I firmly believe that we're going to require black hole excision as well. Again, the computational demands are enormous. We need teraflop machines, terabyte class, but that means we need to be doing, you know, many teraflop, or, you know, we need computers that are significantly larger than we have now, and we need dedicated access, and probably several of them. And this is what the state-of-the-art is for three-dimensional black hole collisions, a relatively state-of-the-art. It's a couple of years old now, but things haven't changed too much. So this is showing a grazing collision of two black holes. The mesh size here is of order 100 by 100 by 100. There's other calculations which approach 400 by 400 by 400. That's about 100 gigabytes. The amount that they can scale by is quite restricted. And so I've just shown three time instants of a particular metric function and a particular equatorial slice. And black hole excision is being used here. Originally, there's two excised regions. And then fairly soon in the calculation, a common event horizon or apparent horizon is detected and excised. And then later on, there's some amount of radiation that's being emitted, but the calculation breaks down shortly thereafter, and you can already sort of see the boundary effects. I mean, one of the problems is that what needs to be infinity is really at a very finite radius, and the order boundary conditions are probably the most problematic issue here. And again, stability is the real key issue here. And all I've done here is blown up the central region at the final time so you can see part of the domain which is being excised. And finally, I don't know, there's probably not many prospective graduate students here, but in case you know somebody who's looking for a PhD topic, the field really has a serious shortage of young researchers, and the funding derivative here is decidedly positive. And in fact, you know, there's a little excerpt here from Physics Today talking about the $600 million richer that Caltech is, and one of the areas of possible spending is in fact numerical general relativity. So Caltech in particular is pretty serious about getting its numerical relativity program up to snuff. And I think this area is going to be becoming even more attractive to universities as instruments such as LIGO start detecting signals, of course. And this is the moral and summary of my research career. I thank you.
Yeah.
15 years away. No, well, I mean, so we got to get that factor of 1,000. There's no doubt about it. So these calculations that Franz is running right down, these adaptive mesh calculations, they're done on a single processor. Because the gains you get from AMR are 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 12th. You know, you just can't get that many processors. So now we can get a factor of maybe 100 by parallelizing, right? So it's not as bleak as 15 years, because what we've been doing up to now has been done on a single processor, and we can get that factor with multiprocessors. But you need the AMR first for anything with significant dynamic range, right? And just bigger computers on a uniformly meshed domain isn't just going to do it.
Shakir and Kolsky computations in the early 90s, they saw in the collapse of their full-age spheroid a trend towards large development of curvature simulations.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
In your computations, do you pass through a regime where you see the curvature?
No, don't see much in the way of spiking up there at all, but which is one of the reasons we wanted to do it with a massive scalar field, because the dynamics here are quite a bit different. You can't kind of localize the massive scalar field in any sense.
Yeah.
I think we could generate those. We haven't really been looking for.
Can't have any toroidal black holes.
No. Right.
Actually, Jim, I was spin off on that paper that found that stuff. It was actually a toroidal event horizon that was seen transiently in the collapse between the large angular momentum.
Right.
But it closed longer.
Yeah, I mean, there's topological censorship which says that has to happen.
Well, Hawking's
I thought
the topology is black hole horizon given positive energy when they're stationary.
Right, when they're stationary, that's the point. But the topological censorship closes that hole too, right? So
I could ask a question. So one problem that I heard when people first started implementing this black hole excision technique, I heard some people complain that it wasn't as good as it sounded, because the constraint equations are really elliptic.
True.
And if you're solving the constraint equations, information can propagate instantaneously,
right.
And so information inside can actually get out.
That's right.
So has that been a problem?
Again, that's the part of that's the kind of the theorist concern. Not that it isn't a concern, but everybody knows. Everybody knows elliptic equations. You know, you twiddle something here and it affects things everywhere, yeah. Right? So. I would say it hasn't been a problem, but you have to come up with a way of implementing the boundary conditions. And fortunately for the constraint equations are always on dynamical variables, so you have evolution equations to use. And so that's what we use. We use evolution equations to provide the values, if we're not using them anyways, for the grid functions at the boundary. The real problem is if you have elliptic equations for coordinate conditions, which is exactly what's being done in those calculations. And there we have this remaining problem, that there's an inconsistency after we start excising with the evolution equations. So numerical relativists, everybody knows that when you're doing these calculations where you just use the evolution equations, they always check the constraints. Well, you can do exactly the same thing. If we're solving the constraints, you have to check the evolution equations to see whether they're being preserved. And they're not being preserved. And that's presumably because we've done something that isn't quite kosher with the way that we're setting the inner conditions on the coordinate conditions. So those are the ones that actually are more problematic for us right now. But any of these sort of superluminal effects or any problem in general, that all comes out in the wash as long as you demand that your solution is stable, right? If you basically have this equivalence with solutions, finite different solutions of PDEs, that if as long as the scheme is consistent, that stability and convergence are more or less are equivalent. So if there was a problem, then we would see that as the resolution went to zero, things would blow up. And we don't see that.
There are these various formulations of the Einstein equation.
Yes.
ADM,
right.
Hyperbolic,
right.
And none.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You test these in your...
I tend to be kind of pragmatic about this. I mean, part of the thing is that we're short on manpower, and it's a little bit distressing to see more papers on formulations of Einstein's equations than on the solutions, right? So I tend to take the, basically, yes, if you count sort of new solution. So I take the approach that, ADM is going to work, that we can make it work. And it may not be the ideal thing, but computationally, okay, the first important issue is stability, but after that it's resolution. And the resolution is set by the physics in the problem. And it may be after the fact that you can say, oh yes, this is the way we should look at the problem, and these are the variables that we should use, and then everything becomes simple. But if you're looking for sort of generic simulations, then I don't think, especially in the nonlinear regime, that it's going to make very much difference one way or the other. The one exception there is the null calculations, where everything simplifies tremendously. And the three-dimensional null codes, single people can write, and you can run reasonable things on reasonable, machines that exist today. And so if it weren't for the problems associated with the formation of caustics, then at least for massless fields, I think that would be the way to go.
Okay, any questions? Let's thank Matt again.